It is lovely to see you all here today at this gathering at our circuit study day. It used to be our circuit local preachers study day, but we thought, why should local preachers get all the good stuff? So we've widened it out, and it's just lovely to see you all here. I think we're in for a very interesting day. I'm really, really looking forward to it. In today's climate, which you'll all be aware of, you know, with the proliferation of St. George Cross flags from street corners, painted on roads, from the attack at the synagogue in Manchester, the arson attack on the mosque over in Peacehaven, a time of disharmony, to say the very least, a time where we as a church need to work out how we best be a witness to the ways of God, to God's kingdom on this earth at this time. And so, speaking of justice in our worship and preaching, speaking of politics in our churches, is an issue which I think really we need to tackle, to grasp by its very metal, so that we can be both a prophetic voice but also a voice of compassion, of love in today's world. So I hope that our speakers will help us on that. And if they don't, well, they're not coming back next time, so that's okay. Welcome specially to Rachel. We'll introduce Rachel in a moment more fully, or she will, and also to Bishop Nick. We thank you for being willing to spend part of this day with us to lead us in our thinking. On each of the tables, there is basically a timetable to tell you what's happening when, and gives you a little bit of information so that you'll know what we're doing. And we're just going to let the speakers have the time that they need as they want, and to use it in the way they'd have. Let me just say that on the back in the corner, there is a table with some books which Bishop Nick has written. There are three books on there. Well, I say there's three books. There's three different books on there. One of them is not for sale. So, and apparently it's the best one that he's written. Okay. Anyway, also we do have a representative here. I can say it this way because it makes it really sound good. A representative from All We Can here, Paul, who's actually just a local preacher in this circuit, really. But he works for All We Can as well. And so he's brought some bits and pieces from there, all to feed into our day. Let's just begin with a prayer. Nameless one of many names, eternal and ever-changing one, who is found nowhere but appears everywhere, beyond and within all, timeless circle of the seasons, unknowable mystery known by all, Lord of the dance, mother of all life, be radiant within us, engulf us with your love. See with our eyes, hear with our ears, breathe with our nostrils, touch with our hands, kiss with our lips. Open our hearts, that we may live free at last, joyful in the single song of all that is, was, or ever shall be. Amen. Amen. And so, Rachel, I'm going to hand over to you. I don't know if you want to introduce yourself. Well, it says on the side who you are, doesn't it, anyway? Oops. So I'll leave it.
Lovely. Thank you very much. It's lovely to be with you today. I'm just going to arrange the furniture a little so that I'm not talking to some empty tables. Do you need to switch that one off?
No, I wonder.
Right. I'm interacting with something, aren't I? Well, it's lovely to be down in Brighton. I grew up for some time in Worthing. My dad was ministering at the Offington Park Church there, so I came down this morning and managed to do a little route. We're going to look at the sea and the pavilion. We often used to come over in the afternoon. That was our afternoon treat sometimes, coming over to Brighton, often when the party conferences were here. That was my parents' idea of a treat. We would come over during the party conference season. We used to live in Blackpool before that. There's this theme here. And we used to come over as children and see which politicians we could spot. And it's weird, isn't it? That's what I grew up with. So you can see why I've ended up here. It was in from an early age. I've worked for the Methodist Church now for about 100 years, helping the church, not just Methodist, but also working with Baptist, United Reformed Church and Church of Scotland. And it's really lovely to see my old friend, Stuart Dew. I think the microphone's gone off. Has it gone off? Is it still on? It's all right? Excellent. I used to work with Stuart as part of the Joint Public Issues Team, helping nonconformist churches to engage with public policy and to campaign for change. And now my role in social justice and social action is helping churches to explore what our call to be justice seekers looks like. So it's great to be spending this time with you this morning. I'm really glad that you've changed it from being a local preacher study day, because I wouldn't get in the door otherwise. My confession is that I'm not a preacher. So I'm glad you've not all screeched at that point. In that the Methodist Church, you have to be formally accredited before you can properly preach. I do keep being invited to bring a word here and there. I heard a program recently about Martin Luther King, which said that he spent 15 hours preparing for every single sermon that he delivered. And my response was, only 15 hours? So I have great gratitude and admiration for all of you proper preachers who spend the time and the prayer and the preparation to lead worship in our churches every Sunday. And it's great to spend time with you today. So I just need to see whether the clicker works now. Yes. So, well, hey. It's a good start, isn't it? So, round your tables. Quick rounds. If you haven't introduced yourselves to each other, could you do that first of all, who you are, where you come from? And then could you just say, when you participated, experienced a really good sermon about justice? You may have preached it yourself, but when was it and why? Okay, so you've got just a few minutes around your tables. When did you hear a really good sermon about justice and why? Okay, could I invite you just to come back now? Andy, I wonder if I could invite you to be my nimble assistant. Could we just have just a few examples of when people experienced, heard a really good justice sermon and why it was good? Just a few examples. Put your hand up. There's one here, there's one over there.
The last really good justice sermon was here on Sunday morning last week.
Brilliant.
Preached by Andy.
How much did you pay him, Andy?
I'm not...
Yeah. It's all right. Just pay
him. Why
was that?
We've had quite a few similar type addresses recently, and that's been really uplifting, the fact that the church is actually thinking about itself in the society in which it exists. Thank and you. What we as church members can do about that.
Brilliant.
We are not powerless. We can all do something, even though it's relatively small.
Fantastic.
And the one thing I've missed is actually preachers who draw a distinction between law and justice.
Okay. Thank you.
They're very, very different things.
Thank you very much indeed. That's great. I think there was a hand over here, is that right?
Oh, actually, I
was
waiting for
Maggie. Oh, were you? Okay. Do you want to use the mic?
And yeah, then, sorry. I suppose picking up on what Tony was saying about, I find myself preaching a lot at the moment about hope and the division that we see in our world and our country, and so having a clear take home, a clear call to action, which shows we do have agency in this. There is all something that we can still do, not give up.
That's that power, doesn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah, thank you for that. Yeah. And then was it Mike? Brilliant. And then perhaps we'll ask a couple of women to speak. Yeah.
Hi. Again, I think that lots of the sermons that I hear have elements of justice in them, but the last great sermon I heard was Bishop Spong. Mm. And it was the Crosswalk America team who'd walked from Phoenix in Arizona to Washington, D.C. So we all met up in Washington, D.C., where Bishop Spong spoke specifically about justice and its relationship to the Christian church. And boy, he could motivate you. It's just extraordinary.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I heard him as a student. That stayed with me. Brilliant. Anybody else like to bring an example? Any women here want to speak up? Invitation, brilliant. Thank you very much.
It's what Terry said, but I think we're not preachers, so we're kind of members of the congregation. It's got to be relatable.
Yeah.
So it can start off as a something in the Bible, a quote or a kind of what have you, but it's got to be then relatable to the society and the context in which we kind of live. It can't stay as a kind of slightly more theoretical, kind of abstract academic kind of analysis. Yeah, it's got to relate. Is that fair enough?
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. So. Thank you for that. And then Kerry here. Thank you.
I was trying to rack my brains about thinking about just one, but what I have noticed is that increasingly preachers are bringing in that call to action as a natural part of their sermon and tying it in with social justice days. So rather than actually one really great sermon, what I'm hearing on a regular basis is that, you know, different themes of social justice being beautifully interweaved with that within the sermons.
That's brilliant. Thank you. That's great. Thank you very much for that. That's really, really encouraging. It sounds like you don't really need me today at all. Themes of that kind of empowerment and response and call to action coming through. But I guess if you got many preachers in a room, there would be some nervousness about doing this and about treading onto this ground. And the title that, I can't remember if I chose or if I was given for this session, of Politics in the Pulpit, had a very sneaky question mark to it, didn't it? So it allows you to kind of sit on the fence and do that kind of thing, which does reflect that nervousness that many preachers, and to be honest, many people in our congregations also have. I've just come back from 3Generate last weekend. I don't know if any of your young people from the circuit went. It was fantastic. I still feel like I've been hit by a brick. I've not caught up by my sleep, but it was just superb. There we had a venue called the Town Hall where young people were invited to come and engage with a whole range of different issues and ways that they could respond. And one of them, they were invited to write to their MPs about their hopes and dreams, things that they wanted to happen in the world. And it was fascinating to see in the letters that they wrote, whilst they were describing what they wanted to happen in the world, the number of them who ended their letters with something like, "You are not doing a good enough job. You are not doing well enough at being MPs." Some of them were a lot ruder, and we may not be able to post them all. But that sense of the failure of politicians amongst our young people who had dreams and hopes and things that they wanted to change, but the sense that politicians were not doing a good enough job. there is in our country, as we are fully aware, this sense of unhappiness, despair around politics. If we start bringing politics into our pulpit, we may not be getting the revival that we are hoping for. So why is it so hard to be preaching about politics in the pulpit? What are some of the reasons that we might choose not to bring politics into the pulpit? Well, you may have heard some of these ones before, that we are being too political. People come to church for a bit of an escape sometimes from all the stuff that's going on out there. Actually, we come for that comfort, don't we? We come for a bit of a safe space, and we don't want all that politics coming in here. There's a fear sometimes that we don't know enough. If we start going down a route and start talking about issues in the world, that actually we don't know enough about the practicalities, the facts, the politics, the policy, and we will be challenged on that. So we just do not want to go there. There's a fear sometimes that we might misuse our position, our spiritual position, you know, the 6 feet above contradiction. But the spiritual position that we have, the power that we have as preachers, when we introduce anything political in there with a small p or a big p, probably a small p, that we may be seen to be misusing our position through that. And then there is just that whole complexity of the Bible as a political text. When we are thinking about the really tricky ones around smiting and slavery, all those texts within the Bible, if we are trying to deal with the Bible as a political text, it is hard sometimes just to go there. And then there is the fear of the hurting, the minefield that we walk into in our congregations, particularly when we are local preachers traveling around and we do not know our congregations. When we start going to places which are political, where there is going to be disagreement, the fear of treading on mines and then walking away as they explode and leaving that behind. You can see why some people don't want to touch on things that can be felt as political, dealing with the whole political text of the Bible. And I think that's particularly difficult at the moment, isn't it? Because of the context that we're in, the rise of the far right that is now explicitly using Christian symbols and Christian language. We saw it, didn't we, at the Unite the Kingdom rally, with chants of Christ the King starting the rally and the crosses being held high. Now, admittedly, at the end of the rally, they were all dumped on the floor outside the tube station, so I don't think it shows a huge respect for the cross. But this very thin approach to the use of Christian symbols and language is going to be reflected in our congregations as well. So we are in that very difficult context, aren't we? And it's going to be hard for preachers to deal with this politics that we are in when we are being political in our preaching. So what I want to try and do over the next kind of 25 minutes or so is three things, if I can. First of all, just to start with some suggestions of where we're located, where Britain is now. Then I want to try and make the case for embracing politics in the pulpit, firstly because it might help our congregations to encounter God differently and to talk about justice differently. And then secondly, because I want to suggest it might help us to encounter God differently. So let's start with where we are now. It's been said that if we are living our lives according to the news cycle that politicians seem dependent on, it's like trying to tell the time by a clock by looking at the second hand. It's accurate, but it makes you feel really sick. And it's exhausting, and it doesn't really help you know where you're at. So if we're trying to wrestle with what politics in the pulpit means, and we're trying to read those signs of the times, yes, we might have a Bible in one hand and a newspaper in the other, or a reliable news feed in the other, as I think it was Karl Barth would say nowadays. We need to try and look at that hour hand, don't we, rather than the dizzying second hand. So I wanted to start by briefly locating us in one, just one analysis of where our country is now. Why does our country feel the way it does? When you are preaching in your churches, when you're active in your wider community, what's going on? What's going on with people? This is based on research by More in Common. They do research into British social psychology, and they've identified four drivers behind this sense of dis-ease that I think we can all sense and see in our society. The first one is this crisis of trust. So 87% of Britons don't have very much trust in politicians or any trust at all. This isn't simply the kind of healthy scepticism that probably we used to have in politics before. This is deep-seated contempt. This is a very different thing that we're talking about. And there is a similar distrust of the judiciary, of the police, of journalists and business. It's only the NHS and scientists who seem to be kind of escaping this. The second driver is around exhaustion and struggle. Half of Britons feel that the cost of living crisis is going to go on forever. It's never going to finish. That's where they see their life's trajectory. And nearly half of Britons say that money is the single greatest stressor in their life. That is the thing that gives them the greatest stress. People in our country are surviving, not living, on a day-to-day basis. The third one is around the rising threat perception. 80% of Britons believe that the world is becoming more dangerous. And this spans everything from escalating international conflicts, energy security, Trump, immigration, perceptions of rising crime, lack of progress around climate change. And this sense of insecurity is particularly pronounced. Am I going off? I've gone, sorry. Ooh, the little light's on. I disappear. Yes. It might just be me waving my arms around.
That's good.
Is that all right?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Just wave and we'll do something. I do get a bit animated. So this sense of insecurity is particularly acute in areas that are affected by economic dislocation. The fourth driver is around the loss of agency. And this is two things. So this is kind of personal. This is people feeling that they can be completely thrown off balance by the next energy bill, the unpredictable energy bill. But it's also a sense, 3 out of 4 people believing that the government doesn't have things under control. This sense of lack of control, loss of agency. And this then leads to this sense that, well, if they can't get things back under control, why don't we just roll the dice and see what happens next? Let's take a chance on whatever happens next. And this is why we are ending up with this increasing fracture in our political landscape and the rapid rise of new parties and people just saying, well, let's give them a go. Let's see what happens there. So this is kind of one picture, and there are other ways of kind of cutting the cake, but I think it's a helpful one in terms of understanding the drivers behind this dis-ease that we have in our country at the moment, and the congregations you're preaching into and the communities that we are part of when we are looking for justice in our wider world. So what do we do with all this? And does politics belong in our pulpits? Well, you won't be surprised that I'm going to say a firm yes to this. Not, though, party politics. I'm talking about politics with a small p, because I believe that politics, if you go to the original root of the word, comes from the citizen, the citizenry, the people. And so politics is about how we choose to live well together. I used to talk about how bananas were political, because When you choose to buy your fair trade banana, you are making a choice about how somebody you'll never meet on the other side of the world is able to educate their children and feed their family. And that is a political choice. You are saying, this is the kind of world that I want to live in. So whilst democracy is an important part of politics, so are so many other things. How we relate to one another on a local level, how we use our power, how we organise, how we make charitable decisions as well, but how we seek justice in so many, so many ways. These are all political decisions. And we see, that's why we see politics in this sense threaded through the Bible and what Jesus talks about and Christian ethical teaching right the way through the centuries. This question of how we live well together. For me, this understanding of politics, how God longs for us to live well together, remains really closely linked to the work that I've been encouraging the Methodist Church to engage with around justice seeking. You said this about the separation between law and justice, and I think I totally agree with you. My understanding of justice that we read in the Bible is about so much more. It's about more than right and wrong, isn't it? God's justice that we see on almost every single page of the Bible is about humans being created in God's image, living with value and dignity. It's about all creation flourishing and human communities within it, about all things being reconciled to each other and to God, about God's special concern for those that that human society in its brokenness pushes to the margins. And it's about the belief that we see God's justice here and now, but we also believe that it will roll like a mighty river and righteousness like a never-ending stream. Just as a quick sideline, the work that I've been doing with the Methodist Church is around a report that went to conference a couple of years ago called A Justice Seeking Church, and it suggests a framework that we might engage with this through. So principles, what does God's justice look like? A summary of six ways that we talk about God's justice. Priorities, so identifying five priority areas of, they won't surprise you, poverty, refugees, discrimination, peace and climate that the Methodist Church has identified for this 5 years. And then practices, not just what we do, but how we do justice. The most important one is not doing justice to people, but being alongside people. I meant to bring copies of the report. They're still sitting in my kitchen. But you can see them all online if you go to methodist.org.uk/justice. But I won't go through that in detail here. We can come back to that later on. But I want to move on to making the case for embracing politics in the pulpit, because it might help us to encounter God's justice differently. We'll all have particular texts from the Bible that make us want to preach about justice or inspire us about justice. I've just quoted Amos, which is one of the ones that I used in my vice presidential address. But we don't often think about the wedding at Cana. Often when we think about the wedding of Cana, we might think about it as being a perfect metaphor for God's joy at creation, the couple coming together, everything being changed but nothing being changed at the same time, wonderful picture of joy. Or we might think about Jesus' repeated emphasis about his resurrection, which it's on the third day. My time has not yet come. It's a story into Jesus's fulfillment and resurrection. But it's still quite an odd story, isn't it, for Jesus's beginning of his ministry. Omnipotent God made man, the Messiah, should take time out of his ministry to perform a miracle, which is really responding to a poor catering decision. And then there's the sheer quantity of wine. I don't know if you've read it recently, but it's 180 gallons. Any idea how many bottles of wine that makes? 900. That is a bigger party than I've ever been to. It's quite something. But if you read this story of the wedding of Cana, through the eyes of Dalit Christians in India, you see something else. It becomes something else. What if the family who were hosting the wedding were poor? What if they simply couldn't afford to buy enough wine for the wedding? If we listen hard enough, you can actually hear the sarcasm in the steward's voice, can't you? Everyone serves the good wine first and then the inferior wine after the guests have become drunk, which is great advice if you want to plan a party. But you've kept the good wine until now. The steward seems to be implying that the wine they'd been drinking up to this point was the cheapest, the most inferior wine possible, that the family has been trying to keep within its budget and they have still run out of wine. I read a thing from Christian Aid. They were talking about one of the African partners that they were working with, and he was saying that his people aspired to a dignified poverty. And the worst thing that they could experience, the worst humiliation of being grindingly poor, was not having anything to set in front of a guest. That was the worst humiliation, not to be able to offer hospitality. So if this was a poor household that had been trying to offer hospitality and had run out of wine at a wedding, that was humiliation. So what Jesus could be showing forth here in this miracle at the start of his ministry was that he was showing abundance, a deliberate abundance, to save a family who were poor from the humiliation of their poverty. Poverty is absolutely about economic hardship, isn't it? But it is also about so many other things. It denies people access to power, to having their voices heard, to being taken seriously. But it also denies people the dignity and that worth that God gives us through our creation.